Tonight, Texas plans to execute John Ballantyne, convicted of killing three teens in an Amarillo home nearly a quarter century before his execution. His appellate attorneys have filed appeals, raising questions about juror misconduct and racial prejudice at his trial. The State Court of Criminal Appeals dismissed those efforts, as well as a lower court ruling that briefly delayed the February 8th death date. His lawyers were left to pursue a last-ditch appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Tonight, we join our listeners.
Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Don't you know they're killing people?
Hello and welcome to our listeners around the world on this Wednesday, February 8th edition of Execution Watch, held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for So What's Your Story with Hank Rubicek, KPFT Houston, listen in on Thursday, February the 9th at 1 p.m. They will be back next week in their 6 o'clock time slot. We do this show to bring about awareness of the death penalty, to shine a light on the people caught up in the system, the arbitrary way in which the death penalty is used as a supposed deterrent, and the suffering this all causes to friends and family of everyone involved. Tonight, we bring you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute 54-year-old John Ballantyne, convicted in the 1998 murder of three white teenagers, Mark Kaler, 17, Kai Brooke Geyer, 15, and Stephen Watson, age 15, in Amarillo, Texas, Potter County. If you've ever been to Amarillo, and we urge all our listeners from around the world and other parts of our nation to come and visit our beautiful state, but if you do come to visit Amarillo, you may notice there aren't very many people of color around town. There were even less in 1998 when John Ballantyne and Misty Kaler became romantically involved. Mr. Ballantyne, who is black, and Miss Kaler, a white woman, were not the accepted norm. Please keep this in mind as we bring you the facts of this case. That, at its heart, this is the case of racial tension, bigotry, and bullying by both the victims and the people who decided Ballantyne's fate. We really didn't expect to be here today. Last week, when we gathered for Wesley Weary's John Ballantyne's execution date was taken off the schedule. But the state of Texas and the county of Potter want this execution to take place today. Well, we're here to shine a light on something the state would rather not make a big deal about, just in case the people of Texas have changed their minds. Well, let's get started. Joining us is our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Hello, Linda. Any news?
There to bear witness because there are eyes letting us know.
That's right.
Great. Linda, you're muted.
Okay. The witnesses just now crossed the line.
Okay, and as we know, when the witnesses cross the line for our listeners in other places, that means that the execution is beginning.
Yes.
Linda, do we know if there are any witnesses standing for John Ballantyne?
Yes, he's got two. Well, most of them are his spiritual advisors that have been with him. They're witnessing. One witness didn't show up. We're not sure it was a James somebody, but we don't know that guy. And he didn't show up.
And anybody for the victims' families?
Supposedly there's two, a whole lot. They had like five witnesses for the victims' family, but I don't know who they are.
Well, we know that John Ballantyne was the last of the litigants who filed in January trying to stop the state of Texas from using expired and substandard drugs in executions. Robert Frata, Wesley Ruiz, those were the first two prisoners that were executed in Texas this year. I know it may be a small point, but have we heard anything else regarding that?
No, I haven't heard anything else. His attorneys didn't say anything else. I know they filed a lawsuit against the United States today over all this, but it got turned down.
Okay. And you know, can you describe the scene outside of the death house for us? It's really such a unique process. Please tell us who's there, what's going on.
Well, we have, you know, of course, Gloria's out here with me, and it's about seven other people that, you know, are abolitionists. And, of course, the guards. And everything is, you know, it's kind of quiet tonight. There's not a lot of people. At least we haven't had anybody be ugly to us and rude.
Nobody's tried to run you off the sidewalk this time.
No, we didn't have any, no motorcycles or anything like that, and nobody's honked and been ugly to us, so...
Tell us about John. Do you know him?
No, I really don't know him. So, but I haven't heard anything bad about him either. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, that's good. Please let us know when the witnesses cross the road again and any updates that you may receive.
I sure will.
Thank you. That was Linda Snyder reporting from Huntsville outside of the death house. And joining us right now is a very special situation we have with us, Elise Bench. Elise, give us a little rundown of the case, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I'll just let you know what's been happening lately in the court system and what we know as far as what's been reported. And of course, we know last week the death warrant was recalled in his case, and his lawyers didn't receive proper notice when it was issued. So at that point, the execution, which was originally scheduled for today, was delayed in absence of the death warrant. And this morning, a Texas court reinstated John's death warrant. The state has every intention of going through, as they stated all week long. They had every intention of going through with today's execution, despite all of the court pending activity. So his team went ahead and appealed to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, today. As we've just heard from Linda and others, that request was denied. And so that means he's cleared to move forward. And as we heard, the witnesses have crossed. And the lawyers previously requested a stay due to the concerning and abject racism presented throughout his trial, including the fact that the foreman regularly, you know, used horrible language in describing John. That request was denied as well. And so at this point, we don't know of any other pending motions, anything that we know of that's out there that can stand in the way of stopping the execution tonight.
Thank you very much for that. There were some horrible things that have come up, I believe, in the appellate stage of this case, and including a couple of very strange notes. One that was actually issued, and I'm quoting The Guardian on this, so please forgive me. Some of the things that we found were the detectives found a note at the crime scene in which Kaylor, who is one of the victims, Mark Kaylor, who was the brother of Misty Kaylor, who was the one who was involved with John. Detectives found a note at the crime scene in which Kaylor had written, "I am going to kill, and I will not say the word." He added the number 187, which is hip-hop slang for murder based on Section 187 of the California Penal Code. So we know that this man, Mark, had various problems. He was definitely an angry young man and was really a very much self-proclaimed racist himself. And so he was determined that his sister was not going to be in a relationship with a black man, is what we understand. It's not a whodunit. Everybody agrees to that. That is a problem, but it is a concept that this man did not have the type of trial or appellate situation that he deserved.
One of the things that's come to light is during his trial, his own defense attorneys pass notes to each other, talking about lynching, justifiable lynching. And when you're talking about someone who's supposed to be getting, you know, great legal assistance in a situation like this, when it's literally life or death, it does seem that when we've seen the papers and we've seen the copies, a lot of evidence apparently has come to light regarding the jurors on this in this trial. Evidently, there was a juror that tried to pass a note to the judge stating that she was uncomfortable applying the death penalty to this case, and the foreman of the jury ripped the note up. And there's other issues with that that I think have that part of the appeals process was they wanted the courts to look at that, and the court refused to look at that.
Well, and didn't even have the other note from the juror saying that that made her uncomfortable.
No, well, I think the attorney for Ballantyne has performed the duty an attorney should, and he's framed all of this and put all the evidence together. I think the problem is that the courts aren't looking at the evidence. Right. It's been dismissed without even being looked at.
At this time, I want to bring in Brother Muhammad, Brother Robert Muhammad, who is a host of KPFT's very, very popular show, Connect the Dots. Brother Muhammad, thank you for joining us today.
Greetings, and thank you for having me on.
I know your show, of course, every Wednesday at 8 p.m., so we will make this as brief as possible, but we are very grateful that you have joined us tonight. And you've been the spiritual advisor to several people on death row before. Tell us a little bit about how you advise someone.
Well, first and foremost, you have to put it in a context that the death penalty is applied in Texas. It's racist and it's anti-poor. There's a saying that we picked up in the abolition movement. It's better to be rich and guilty than to be poor and innocent. So as we listen to the case of John Ballantyne, we see there's a racial aspect to it, and there also is ineffective counsel. And it appears that, once again, we are not serving justice, but it is indeed revenge. How you advise someone at that point, if a person in the case of Shaka Sankofa, who was executed on June the 22nd, 2000, Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham, where there was sufficient evidence to believe that he was indeed innocent of the crime he was convicted for and sentenced to death as a 17-year-old juvenile, it's hard to advise a man like that. All you can do is basically comfort him and listen to the things that he had to say, which I basically documented and wrote down on a pad as we talked, as it was in the holding cell. And he said that, you know, they used the death penalty to control us, to try to control us by making us afraid. And it's unfortunate that this is the case where we don't seem to want to redeem people. As a spiritual man myself, we don't want to redeem people, but we want to kill them. It's more revenge than it is justice. The state of Texas, they kill born-again Christians. State of Texas, they kill the mentally ill. In the state of Texas, they executed, again, a juvenile. And so we also look where the spiritual advisor to Odell Barnes, which was executed on March the 1st, 2000, out of Wichita Falls. The French abolition movement literally paid $50,000 to do a forensic study of his case and conviction. And they were convinced that he, too, was innocent. But you sit and you do the best you can to comfort them and the family and those who have fought for their freedom. And it takes a toll on the spiritual advisor, because to sit in that death chamber as a witness and to watch someone that you've bonded to, basically they've shared with you their soul, their aspirations, their dreams, their desires, their regrets, in terms of things they wish they'd done in life. And then you watch the life leave out of them, and they give their last statement and their last words to you. It leaves an impact on you and your soul, and makes you one that will continue to fight for justice and to abolish this wicked, anti-poor, racist death penalty. And I'll close by simply saying, Marlo, unless you have any further questions, and I'll be glad to stay on a little while longer. In fact, my show comes on a Tuesday, so I got preempted by Mr. Biden. So anyway, I think I might have said Wednesday because I've switched around so many times. But
my Tuesday. Apologies, Brother Muhammad. My apologies.
We're good. We're good. But I want to commend those who go up to Huntsville, Gloria, and the other activists. They have been steady. And I continue to call out for justice for the poor and people of color in this state and this Texas Department of Corrections or Corruptions that we see from top to bottom. Our communities are over-policed. We are more likely to be prosecuted more harshly, charged with higher crimes, and unfortunately sentenced more harshly. And as long as that continues, there will always be abolition activists and those who fight for fairness in the criminal justice system.
We are very fortunate, in fact, to have some of those activists who do fight and who are standing out in the rain and the cold in Huntsville right this very moment. Let's bring in Gloria Rubick, if we may. Gloria, unmute.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much. Now, fortunately for us, Gloria suggested that we bring in Brother Muhammad into this discussion, and I appreciate that. Gloria, do you know John? Did you know him?
No, I didn't. But Saturday night when I was visiting at death row,
right,
I got to smile at him and mouth good luck to him. I believe he was visiting with one of his lawyers and also two younger people that I think was maybe a child and a grandchild of his.
Nice to know that there were some family there and family around him. Can I ask if you have any questions for Brother Muhammad before we let him go?
Yeah, you never answered my phone call, dude.
Remember our promise, Gloria.
Behave, Gloria.
Behave, Gloria.
Okay, I'm going to call you later, Minister. I just think that one of the things that's happening right now in Texas is that there's a professor named Sandy Joy who's traveling the country who got she got a year sabbatical, I guess, and she's doing research on people who have witnessed executions. And I particularly wanted Minister Muhammad to get with her because not only did he witness executions of innocent people, he was a spiritual advisor, and he was also quite traumatized by his experience, like most of us have been who have witnessed. So, I think her webpage is bearingwitness.com. But anyway,
what is that like, Brother Muhammad? What is that like? You have been there.
I wrote an essay called Dancing with Demons. Okay. Because prayer, fasting, all the things that a spiritual man would do in our religious tradition was sufficient, but yet insufficient. Because there are things that I experienced on death row, the smell of the fresh paint, the color gray, the sound of the gates closing and not closing. All of these are triggers. All of these are that which will re-stimulate. And then always thinking about Shaka and the things that he said, they're killing me tonight, they're murdering me tonight. And then as he, and I can always remember seeing his head turn to the side with his eyes open, looking at us who were his witnesses. So that doesn't go away.
Never.
But it has to be dealt with. And so it's very traumatizing from that standpoint. And as much as I do correspond with those who in Livingston and other facilities in TDC and on the federal level, I really would be very reluctant to go and be a witness again of the execution. Not that I wouldn't go and visit with them, be a spiritual advisor, but to be a witness, I don't think I could do it again and really hold my tongue as to I'm watching, because I know the injustice that's being perpetrated against poor and people of color. And most of you, you know, as you look in just a website, what is the average educational level of those in TDC? So we have, what is their family situation? So when we look at all of these factors of how the society, in one sense, had failed them. And that doesn't excuse whatever they did wrong. And there should be some penalty paid. But it should not be harsher because you're poor or because you're a person of color. That is what I mean by the scales of justice. She's supposed to be blind. And she's supposed to weigh the evidence based upon the evidence and not sentence you to something longer because, one, you had ineffective counsel, one who's being paid by the state and really is not, you know, so much interested in the case of Ron Mark. And, you know, I'd say that name, Mr. Gloria reacted, Ron Mark and others. So you have ineffective counsel. And then in the standpoint of just people just, I mean, we sent more people to death row from Harris County than some states in the whole union that had the death penalty. So, you know, this struggle must continue, and we must bring about the fairness, justice, true justice. Is the law of justice to be applied equally, regardless of creed, class, or color? But until that happens, well, our spirit is to continue to fight, and even then to be very vigilant and watchful over this criminal injustice system.
Do either of you have suggestions of what we should do and what other people listening can do to help change this system?
Gloria, you'll have to move that. Gloria, what? You'll have to move the light. Truck's coming.
There's several things people can do, and I've got to move something so a car can get by. There's all something people can do. You don't have to go out and raise Cain like I do. You can do very simple things. Talk to your pastor or your minister or your religious people, contact your legislators. We're going to be lobbying, as Ray Hill used to say, fortunately, the legislature only meets every 2 years. But we're going to have lobby training at Shape Center on Saturday, February 25th. And then once the bills get to committee, we're going to be going to Austin. You're welcome to join us for that. There's just so many things that people can do. Make a phone call. Call the governor, 512-463-3000.
2000.
Thank you. I should know that.
Give us that number again, 512-463 what?
2000.
2000.
Uh-huh. There's people on... Well, you know, the weirdest thing just happened. They just got TVs in the day row on death row. So that's quite a thing. But not everybody can see them. So there's many people, because of the continuous solitary confinement, that are literally losing their mind. And people that I used to be in touch with are no longer there. They're just a shell of the person they used to be. But there's newspaper subscriptions or magazine subscriptions you could buy for somebody on death row. Write a letter to somebody who's got an execution date and tell them you're hoping or praying or whatever you do for them. Or thank you. People are actually coming by here and honking tonight, which is exciting. When we first started coming out here in the 80s, people would come by and F you and give us the finger and fry them and oh. But even in Huntsville, you know what happened a couple of years back? After an execution, a group of us went to eat and we got up to pay. And the owner of the restaurant said, your bill has been taken care of. And we're like, what? And he said, yeah, he figured y'all had had a bad day. This is in Huntsville.
Wow.
That's just so amazing. People change.
Thank you, Gloria. I'd like to bring in Clinton Young right now, if I may. Clinton, you were on death row for almost 18 and a half years. I don't know how to do this, but I'd like to know what an ordinary day on death row is like.
Okay. Right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, that's Gloria, I think.
People on Facebook, well, can they hear this?
Hold on. They come around? Okay, the officers come around about 5:15 to 5:30 and ask if you're going to rec or shower, things like that. And if you're going, and rec time is anywhere between 5:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, if they have staff. Which recent times they haven't had a lot of staff, right? And so guys are not getting wrecked and shower. Everything is done alone. You're handcuffed behind your back. You know, you're strip searched every time you leave the cell, the shower, the day room. And again, anytime you're escorted from one place to the next, you're handcuffed behind your back. They feed breakfast at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and then lunch at 10 o'clock, and then last chow around 4:30. And so it's like Groundhog Day. It's basically the same thing every day. There might be a little bit of excitement or different variations here or there of when you leave the cell, but it's basically the same thing every day. It's just a tedious, repetitive process, right?
I want to come back to this in just a second, but I do want our listeners to know that you are listening to a very special episode of Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM. And Houston Media Source in through their wonderful studios, and I thank them very much for everything that they do for this program. And Brother Muhammad, I know you have things to do. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to let you go at this point in time, and we're going to go on with the show, if that's all right with you, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, let me just say again, Marlo, thank
Please.
You, and thank all of those who are part of this program. And lastly, to add on to what Gloria said, we can be supportive of the families, for they're traumatized also by their loved one being on death row. And as I'm listening to this former death row inmate, he may have lost friends, he may have lost family, children, brothers, sisters, siblings, others that have grown up, elders that have passed away that he would have loved to attend their funerals. There's so much of life that is lost and traumatized, and now he's free. And all of that, he can't get back. And in many cases, like in the case of Clarence Brantley, didn't get a dime.
Right.
What they do to him. So again, let us be supportive in a holistic way. And I pray for the blessings on everybody that would fight for justice. And once again, thank you, KPFT, for being the voice of the voiceless and help for the help and those who don't have help.
Thank you.
And call me Gloria. I will answer your call this time. Thank you, Marlo.
Thank you so much, Brother Muhammad. Again, you can listen to Connect the Dots on KPFT Houston every Tuesday at 8 p.m. unless Joe Biden is doing a State of the Union, then I guess you're just going to have to wait another week. Let's get back to our discussion. Clinton, you know, you use a lot of lingo that we don't understand a lot of the time as well. Things like level three and lockdown. And can you, is it just, does everything become sort of an encryption? I mean, you say that it's like Groundhog's Day when you go through a day on death row. How does the language itself develop, I guess?
Well, I mean, TDC has policy, right? I mean, there's prison slang, but generally like level three, that's TDC's disciplinary level classification.
What does that mean?
And so, well, it's just if a person loses, it's the most punitive level there is. Say it's supposed to be reserved for like worst of the worst or assaultive behavior or things like that. But it depends on what major you have. And some majors, they put you on level three for this little stupid stuff. It just, I mean, because they control the classification committee. But generally, I guess to keep it short is, if you go level three, you only get one visit a month, and you only get to go to rec three times a week and for 1 hour if you're not on cell restriction. And then you lose all your commissary, all your electronics, and all you basically get was state-issue stuff. They modified that in recent years where you could get, you actually take your commissary hygiene with you if you wasn't on property restriction. They put you on property restriction when you go level two or level three, then you don't have nothing but what the state gives you and your legal work and your Bible and your correspondence material. And it's for 90 days. It lasts 90 days. Well, level three lasts 30 days. Then you go to level two, which lasts 60 days. And then you can get your level one back if you don't get no more disciplinary cases.
So basically you just go from one form of hell to the next.
Right. And level two and level three, there's no difference. I mean, you get level two, you get one extra visit a month and one other day of out of rec time, but it's still the same as far as everything else goes. And you still do 90 days. So it's like kind of pointless. Let's go level two. Yeah, my philosophy was when I was acting up was level two is 90 days. Level three is still 90 days. So if y'all going to put me on level, I might as well go level three.
Yeah. Well, last time we were gathered here, I asked you about living in solitary confinement. And would you please tell us what that's like and how do people change?
It's torture. I mean, that's the simplest way to put it, right? It's just you're stuck in a little box and it makes you totally dependent upon officers. I remember one time the water was cut off. Pepper sprayed or stuff like that, you go to level. Sometimes, well, it really depends on who you was. But I've seen them do this to other people where the officers turn the water off to the cell and things like that. But there's one particular time that they came around and shut the water off because they was working on some valves or something like that. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you couldn't flush the toilet. Ah. And you couldn't get no water. You had to depend on them to bring you water. And I was sitting there thinking about this. I was like, dang, man, they have so much control of my life. Like, I can't even flush my toilet right now. And that's just what it is. I mean, it was designed to make an individual totally dependent upon the correctional officer. So as the idea behind it was to make them dependent upon the captors, the officers, and therefore break a person mentally so that they would be subservient to the officers, you know, because I guess if you get along with the officers more, you're more compliant that your life is then better. And so when a person is supposed to get out of solitary confinement, they'll be a better prisoner. And they also included adding in pharmaceuticals to help, I guess the combination of the cell and the pharmaceuticals, the whole intention is, well, it's not guess, that's what the whole intention was to basically rewire the prisoner.
Right.
All right. And there's a slew of prisoners on death row. I don't like using that type of objectifying term. There's a slew of men on death row who take psych meds, you know, for one reason or another. And so I think they said it was like 60% take medication and have some type of like interaction with MHMR.
Right.
I mean, that's crazy, right? I mean, like, but it ain't just death row. There's other prisoners they place back there too.
Right.
For various reasons. And, but it's just the problem with death row was, like, if I'm an ASIG and say, I'm there for disciplinary, I'm there for affiliations, there can be a light at the tunnel that there's ways that I could get out of SIG. Okay. Yeah. But when it comes to death row, it's like the only way I'm getting out this cell is if they kill me, I get a new trial, or they give me a life sentence. The craziest thing is, it's like there's thousands of people in TDC for capital murders. They just was from counties that didn't want to spend the money and gave them a life sentence. And that's the example I used to make is I have a real good friend of mine that's on death row, Randy Halpern. And he was there based on the law of parties.
Right.
Didn't kill nobody. They 100% admit he didn't shoot nobody. He didn't kill nobody. He didn't have no gun. None of that stuff. But yet he's on death row. He's part of what they call the Texas Seven.
Right.
And so he's there. But yet there's a guy in population on Pulaski unit that's got 5 capital life sentences. Mm. All right. It takes a lot to rack up 5 capital life sentences.
Yeah, it does.
He's a population.
Let me ask.
But he gets contact visits. Everything.
Let me ask Gloria Rubik another question, if I may. Gloria, you posted on Facebook the other day about a recent suicide on death row. Can you tell our listeners about that?
A man by the name of Terrence Andrews committed suicide last week, I believe. He'd been on the row for quite a while. I don't remember how many years. Apparently last June, the Supreme Court turned him down and he had no other appeals. And he became very despondent. And, you know, I don't know what was the straw that broke the camel's back, but he did kill himself. And I think it's so important for us to remember that these people never get out of solitary, never. So that destroys something in people. You know, Clinton has spoken about that. Terrence's family, I read, had buried him and so on, but the state, you could, they're coming out. Oh, merciful heavens. Okay. The state, you could say, well, the state didn't kill him, he killed himself.
That was on time actually, for when they did Annabelle.
The state did kill him.
Yes.
Linda?
Yes. The witnesses are going back across the road. So it's over.
The witnesses are crossing the road in Huntsville. That means that the execution has been completed and John Ballantyne is no longer of this earth. John Ballantyne's sentence has been carried out by the state of Texas in Huntsville, Texas, this evening on this dark and very cold evening. Thank you, Linda, for reporting on that.
Marlo?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say something. You know, February
Please, Gloria.
Is Black History Month, and the man that was just legally lynched was an African-American man. But I think it's important for people to know that 75% of the people on death row are people of color. 75%. Black people are 12%. Of the population of Texas. The death penalty and racism are so intertwined that they will never be separated, period. It's kind of like mixing Kool-Aid. Once you pour the Kool-Aid in the water, you can't separate it. And that's how racism and the death penalty are. And I wanted to say say hello to T, to Spider, and Arthur Brown. I hope you got my e-message, and I hope to hear from you. Arthur has a date, March
coming up.
7th, yeah.
It's just, in fact, they are really gearing up the execution machine here in Texas. And not only Gary Green, of course, is going to be March 7th. March 9th will be Arthur Brown. And the 29th will be Anibal Canales. So that's going to be three executions in the month of March. They're not messing around, people. They are not stopping the train, whether it is because of the drugs that they use or whether it's because they're concerned they just can't do it fast enough. We are not sure. Let me bring in Meryl, please. Meryl Partier, thank you so much for coming and joining us today. We do appreciate it. Meryl, Sean Nolan, one of Ballantyne's attorneys, said that the reinstatement of tonight's execution will surely violate due process. Can you expand on that line of thinking and why she said that?
Well, the issue was that his attorneys were not properly notified with John Ballantyne's execution warrant. Mm-hmm. And its Texas Code of Criminal Procedure says they need to be notified within a certain time frame, and that didn't happen. So the lower court stayed his recalled his execution date because of that, because the attorneys need to be properly notified because you want to file appeals, right? That's the due process that people on death row get. And so that didn't happen. But unfortunately, the CCA a couple hours ago overruled that decision. And they said, well, apparently it doesn't matter. I couldn't find the CCA's order on that, so I don't know what their reasoning was. But apparently they don't care too much about the due process and about notifying defendants' attorneys within a reasonable time period.
The appeals court did deny a request from Ballantyne's lawyer. We've heard that, to stay his execution over allegations that racism and racial issues pervaded his trial. Now, the appeals court denied the stay request on procedural grounds without reviewing the merits of those claims. Can you please explain to us what that means and what are the consequences of something like that? How is that?
He probably had those issues before, and they were probably raised in earlier writ applications, mm-hmm. and reviewed and maybe denied. Clinton can probably tell you more about that because he knew a lot about them or some about the cases.
Right.
So he should have raised it earlier, basically. Or it was raised earlier and it was denied, and then you cannot raise it again. If it's the same issue, if you don't have any new evidence, you can't raise that again in a writ application if it's already been denied in a previous one.
You have a question?
Yeah.
Elise Finch here.
Hi, thanks for joining us. I had a question about, I was reading in the Texas Observer magazine recently that there are some allegations about maybe some ethical misconduct with the lawyers for the TDCJ, specifically regarding when Robert Frada had his case before the judge, and that the attorneys for the state didn't reveal that the state had actually obtained additional doses of phenobarbital. And my question to you would be, with regard to the ethics, especially when it comes to the TDCJ attorneys, it seems like they should be held to the absolute highest standard here. And if they had information that they didn't divulge, what does that mean ethically and morally?
Well, I know the lawsuit that was filed that was separate. It's not a criminal lawsuit that was filed. It was a civil lawsuit over the use of expired drugs in executions. And the court said that in those civil procedures, executions cannot be stayed. So that's unfortunate, because even if information is not disclosed, or, you know, it's a whole separate thing. It's separate from their criminal proceedings. So that's why those three men could still be executed, even though they had this civil lawsuit going on. It's separate. And in civilly, they can't stay the criminal execution because it's in the criminal proceeding. So even though they may have withheld information in that civil lawsuit, it's going to have no effect on the criminal proceedings.
So I guess my question would be, who holds the attorneys accountable for the state of Texas if they perhaps violated any kind of ethics that they would need to be held to, just with maybe the Bar Association? Or if you could break that down for us a little bit as an attorney and let us know what that would be like, if they could face any consequences. And if so, who would be the ones to bring that to light?
Oh, yeah, sure. Anyone who knows of a ethical violation, I have, as an attorney, have an obligation to report that to the Texas State Bar. Every attorney has that. And so we all fall under the same ethical rules that we have to follow. So you can file an ethical complaint. But what I would also like to add is, you know, we as a society, you know, journalists, documentary makers, advocates, such as Gloria and Linda, attorneys, we should all hold those people accountable. And we cannot always do it in a courtroom, but we could do it by changing public's opinion. So we can do it through media. And I think that's an important way to stand up and, you know, demand some action and change.
I have one final question, if
please.
I may. So it seems as if the third prisoner, or the third man was executed tonight. That was also a part of the lawsuit.
Recording
that we
in
mentioned
progress.
Earlier. That leaves, I believe, two more.
They're both gone.
Okay, they're both.
Both Robert Frada and Wesley Ruiz are already executed.
Were there four or five?
Just three.
Just three. So what happens to the lawsuit now?
It's moot. So they can't.
They don't.
There's no lawsuit.
So it just goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's over with.
Is Gloria still there? Or Linda?
No, she left. Gloria left.
Okay. Well, yeah, yeah, that's her thing. What happens after the execution?
We're all still here.
Linda, what yes. happens? What happens to
he
John Ballantyne now?
He will now go to the church, and his loved ones can actually touch him for the first time. He'll still be warm. It's very heartbreaking, and because they don't let the family see him, you know, or hug him or anything before the execution, only after they're at the church. And then, you know, then wow. they'll take his home in Houston, and there he will be cremated.
Now, we know you have an organization that you work with, the Angels. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about what you so often have to do?
No, you never can.
No, we're not dead.
Oh, but not
this is, you know, during the execution.
Can you hear me?
I can now. Did you hear my question? Linda?
I just lost him.
We are here at KPFT. We are talking with Linda Snyder, who is outside of the Death House in Huntsville. For those of you who may just be joining us, if you're here for So What's Your Story, please come back next week or listen in tomorrow at 1 p.m. When they will actually have their regularly scheduled show for this week. Linda, tell us a little bit about your organization, please, the Angels.
Death Row Angels. Well, we pay for cremations. If the guys want to be cremated, we take care of that. And we also help feed the guys that don't have any family or anything. We give them, you know, e-coms, do like that for them. We visit them every week. And we help them out in any way we can.
And to our listeners, these ladies, these activists, these men, they don't live in Huntsville, Texas. They travel miles, hundreds of miles often, one way just to make these visits and to try to make a little bit more sense out of what's going on and to give us a more humanized version of what is happening with these people. Clinton, talk a little bit. What happens after an execution? Is there any conversation about it on the row? Do you talk with other people about it?
It's a case by case basis, right?
Right.
In recent times, there's been more showing of solidarity. Thanks to Ricky Cummings, Mr. Landry, and a couple others.
And Sandy admit people.
When you do little things like, for example, not talking to the officers, or some people don't eat on execution day, those different people have different forms of protest on that day, right? It helps keep it real, to be honest with you. I mean, it helps, instead of being like an ostrich and burying your head in the sand, it just kind of drives the point home that they're there to kill us, you know? And there's this different, you know, things like, it just depends on case by case basis. Like, I mean, there might be a conversation today about the lawsuit issue, or TDC hiding the drugs, or different things, because like TDC hiding the drugs, that affects everybody, you know. Or there might be stories about Valentine himself, or, you know, it just depends on different people going to have different conversations, and it depends on who's being executed.
Clinton, what is the strangest thing about being out in the world again?
<laughs> 18 and a half years,
that's a long, long time.
I mean, it's pretty much the same. I mean, it's just the way people interact. I mean, the effect that social media has had on society.
Right.
In general, you know, that's a different thing, right? Like, people don't conversate in the public sphere as much as before I went in.
We've really been enjoying you joining us, and I'm sorry that we've had so many of these executions that we've had more time than we would like to actually discuss these things with you. We want you back again, but tell me, how do you see your life from here out?
I don't know. I mean, my trial's coming up. And so I don't know what will happen. I mean, you know, they tried to put me back in jail and keep me locked up and keep me shackled and on and on while I was in jail, so they could argue future dangerousness. But I don't know what's going to happen, right? I mean, I'm going to keep fighting them one way or another. I'm going to keep speaking out.
Right.
I'm me. And so I don't know. But like I said, I mean, what the future? I don't know. I just live my life, huh?
Right.
You know, like my boy Zilla says, you know, 1/4 mile at a time. And so it's just, I don't know, I mean, life is beautiful out here, right? I mean, my worst day out here was better than my best day in there.
Right.
And so I try to make the most of it. I got a bit more freedom now. They cut the angle monitor off of me. And, you know, I just try to see the blessings in life. I go to work and really just be a normal citizen, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is, right? I would like to, ever quick, because time's about to run out, if you don't mind, Marlo.
Of course.
To really drive home, to finish what I was saying a minute ago, and I'll keep it quick, is that you have thousands of people locked up for capital murder for the same offenses that people on death row. Only difference is they came from Tarrant County versus Travis County, which is
right.
Tarrant County is more conservative, Travis County is more liberal. And so based on the politics is why they're on death row, and yet they're subject to solitary confinement. But if they would have came from a liberal county, you know, then they would have contact visits, group rec, access to the phone all day. They could get a job. They could get education, services, on and on and on. They could participate in more religious activities. And so, but the only difference is, it's capital murder. Capital, you know, across the board. But the only difference is, you know, this DA chose to seek the death penalty and that DA didn't. And so that's what really makes it worse that people on death row in solitary confinement is because it's a result of a purely political action, okay, is what put them there versus life in prison. And then you add in lawyers and police misconduct, prosecutor misconduct and all that, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And on a Ballantyne about the legal situation, what I think it was is that he had lawyers on his initial appeals that did not do the proper thing. And so his lawyers now tried to bring it up, but the CCA procedurally barred him. So basically they say they hold us responsible if our lawyers mess up.
Right. Quick question from Elise Bench for you.
Hey, Clinton, I just wondered, you know, days like today, and we have more of these coming up, unfortunately, that we'll be broadcasting and covering future executions. I imagine it takes an emotional and mental toll on you simply because of your closeness to, you know, so many of the men that are still there. Your ability to kind of see things in, from a different lens and with a different perspective now that you're on the other side. Do you have any, I'm sure you're an example and you're also a sort of hopeful for the people that are inside that are aware of your situation. Do you have any final words, any words you'd like to give those that are still inside that are maybe not looking at things with the same lens as you?
Oh, I mean, look, I still kind of see it with the same lens because of what I'm facing. And plus, I have a habit of still saying, when talking about death row, saying we or us, you know. I got a lot of friends still there. I mean, there's people I got a lot. I mean, guys that I love, man, that I just developed great friendships with over the years. And, you know, I'm out here, I'm speaking to people, I'm fighting for them still, right? I'm going to continue to be an advocate. And it, you know, like I always say, they got to keep fighting. They got them tablets now, so they have access to LexisNexis, so they have a better access to the law library, which used to be more restricted if you was on death row, which was another thing. And so, I mean, that's why I say just keep fighting, man, and get people to reach out to their politicians. You know, a lot of politicians, it's amazing to me how many politicians are just totally clueless about how the reality of death row is.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's
because people don't speak to the politicians.
You are right. And it's very important for everyone to remember that Texas votes for not only our DAs, but also for our judges. And let's all remember that.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. They all can win by very few votes.
All right. It's time for us to wrap up execution for today. Please join us March 7th when Texas plans to usher Gary Green into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. And then again on March 9th for Arthur Brown, and then on the 29th for Anibal Canales. If he does execution watch, we'll cover the state-sanctioned killing with our live news coverage. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, we're on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, where you can also get on our mailing list. Thank you to our guests, Meryl Pontier, Clinton Young, Brother Robert Muhammad, Gloria Rubick, our death reporter, Linda Snyder.
Can anybody hear
executive
me?
Executive producer, Elizabeth
no.
Stein.
Give
information coordinator and fact checker, yes. Elise Bench. Sarah Sox Cooney, social media,
Adriana.
And Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor, Otis McQuay.
You are echoing.